our radio show. This is the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, AGMD. And my name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I will be having somebody else on the line, on the program as well. Her name is Brittany Neal. She's going to join us today, trying to figure out some technical issues, but we're just so delighted that you're able to listen in and maybe call if you feel inclined to do so. So let me first start off by telling you a little bit about the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders. The organization was started in 1991. It has grown immeasurably. Every day we're getting more people who are finding our organization. Our organization is comprised of expert medical, dietitian, and scientific advisory board. They all are just, I can't say enough about them, because every time we do a program, they're always willing to step up to the plate and help. Our organization helps to draw awareness, advocate, and educate those all different types of digestive motility disorders. And in addition, we provide much needed support to patients as well as their families. So today, let me tell you a little bit about myself for those who don't know me. I know my name is so long, it's probably going to take up half the radio show just saying it, but it is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I am a longtime patient with multiple digestive motility disorders and other diseases. And my journey started when I was 26 years old. So in 1979, the year I was to get married, suddenly these symptoms just came into play. And it took 5 years before I was diagnosed. My illnesses include chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudoobstruction, malabsorption, pernicious anemia, gastroparesis, achalasia, reflux, and diffuse esophageal spasms. My bladder has also been affected. When I was first diagnosed, I was a teacher, and the symptoms came on suddenly. And I was spending time in the bathroom. I was constipated. And yet I had mucus diarrhea, I had abdominal pain, I felt nauseous, and I was having trouble eating. But even with those symptoms, I kept on working, and I was going from doctor to doctor until they could figure out what was wrong. And then some of the diagnoses or misdiagnoses were, it's irritable bowel, it's colitis, it's all from stress. And then ultimately it was, you have an eating disorder. So finally, within that 5 years, I was on more medications, antidepressants, antispasmodics, everything, you name it. I had tried it or was on it, and I was getting worse instead of better. So then 5 years into our marriage, I ended up going to a doctor who finally suspected that what I have might be a motility disorder. I ended up in the hospital, and by the time I left the hospital, I was 69 pounds. So this particular doctor said, let's have you do some motility studies. Well, nobody had ever heard of motility disorders. And we spent, both my husband and I spent a long time at that hospital taking me, for me to take various tests, and he was so supportive. So I ended up having these prehistoric, because motility tests were in their prehistoric form and insurance didn't cover any of it. Ultimately, the doctor said, you have what's called chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudoobstruction. And he wanted to remove part of my intestinal tract. But at the time, I was only 69 pounds. I really didn't think I would live through the surgery. And also, I felt that There were too many questions that were still begging for answers. Well, if they removed part of my intestines, would they guarantee that this wouldn't progress to another part of my digestive tract? And what caused this? And would I get worse with the surgery? And there weren't any answers, so I ended up not having the surgery, and the doctor was most upset, so he let me, he told me that I needed to seek psychiatric care, and with that, he said that he would no longer treat me as a patient unless I sought psychiatric care, and he left me. So for many years, I was left without any type of help. Eventually, I found these wonderful doctors, and they assisted me throughout the time, and now I'm left with a gastroenterologist who is so supportive and is there for me. I'm the only patient who has such a complex medical history with all of these different types of motility disorders, but they, this doctor is so compassionate and willing to work with me. And in addition, we have this other, my primary care, who again is just works with me and helps to monitor my treatment. And what I like about them is they don't impose their opinions on what I have to do. For example, when I ended up being of the age to have colonoscopies, my doctor said, I know you are at the age where you should be having them, but there are two reasons why I'm not going to have you do it. Number one is that I know you won't. And number two is that if you have that colonoscopy and you have to do that prep, that will significantly have an effect on you and it will set you back. So I'm not going to put you through that. And I appreciated that so much. So in summary, with all these different types of motility disorders, one of the challenges that we all face is that they're so unpredictable in nature. My symptoms came on suddenly, totally unexpected. And some days they were worse than others. This was all a new environment for me, as well as my husband and family. And I think that that is one of the big struggles that so many patients and their families do try to cope with. Because I hear from patients all the time that they have trouble trying to help have others understand what they're going through, but they don't even understand it themselves. And why is a patient able to eat one day and then the next moment they're unable to? Why is a person able to eat a certain food at one point and then suddenly they're unable to eat food? So that same food, whether it's supposing you have Jell-O and you're okay with that at that moment, and then the next time you go to eat Jell-O and it may be the same portion, same flavor, nothing has changed, it gets you on your knees in pain, or you start vomiting, or you have nausea. And another problem is that you never know when these symptoms are going to come on, but also the intensity. Sometimes they're tolerable because now you're used to it, and other times they can, again, get you on your knees because they're so debilitating. Other times, the symptoms can only last for a few minutes, and then the next thing you know, they're gone. But other times, you can get those symptoms, and they can last for minutes, weeks, months, and even years, unrelentingly. So the duration, the intensity, and when they occur, it's all up in the air. And of course, all of this impacts our lives. There are so many what-ifs that we live in. hold on a minute. I'm just going to see if anybody. So I think we may have Brittany there. Brittany, are you on? No. Okay. Well, we're still learning these controls. It's all new. But so let me talk a little bit more about the problems with this type of thing. Give me 1 second because I'm just checking out some of the messages that I may be getting here in regards to the program. So one of the things, too, is that taking medication can be just so challenging. You never know when you take a medication, and just like everything else, when you take a medication, it may not bother you, and then suddenly it does bother you. And this is so frustrating to patients because they never know. I know when every time I have to try a medication, I take it just a little bit of a quarter of a pill and see how my body responds. And then I may try that another day and another day. And then if I feel the courage, and it does take courage to eat, to take medication, to do all of these things, then it's very unsettling. So that courage that is needed is so important. And it's hard to explain to doctors, well, I just took this little bit of medication, and then you have to tell them, well, it's worked before or it doesn't work now. I used to be able to take penicillin growing up. Now I can't at all, and I break out in hives and a rash. So the medication issue is huge. And I had an experience where I was prescribed some eye drops, and I put them in. I didn't think anything of doing eye drops. It was totally unrelated to consuming something by mouth or by suppository or injection. And by the next day, I started to feel very ill. The nausea heightened. I started vomiting more. And I just felt so weak and like I was getting the flu. And then I started to get little rashes all over my body. And by the next day, I had to lie down. I was totally debilitated. And I realized that that was from eye drops that caused this whole systemic type of a problem. So it certainly is a balancing act. Brittany, are you on yet?
Yes.
Oh, Brittany.
Yes, I am.
Oh, I'm so glad. Introduce yourself a little bit because we have you here today, and I'm so glad that you were able to get on. Tell us a little bit about yourself, because then the next thing I want to talk about is traveling, which I can't travel anymore, but you've had some experience traveling. So if you can introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your background, and also you can talk about the problems you may have had with travel and perhaps how you deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Hi, everybody. My name is Brittany. I was born with chronic intestinal pseudoobstruction disease, and my signs and symptoms started right off the bat. Within 24 hours after being born, I still hadn't passed any stools or anything else for that matter. But the doctor still sent me home. Why, we're still questioning that. And shortly after being home, I started projectile vomiting. And my parents rushed me back into the hospital. I was transferred to one of the university hospitals where I live. And within my first 3 days of being alive, I had my first surgery. They believed that I had an obstruction, so they performed surgery to, at that point, they thought they would be removing the obstruction, but they found that I did not actually have an obstruction. But when they went in, I will still remember how the doctors how my parents told me the doctors put this to them. My intestines looked like wet noodles. And they found that there's these cells that are found within the intestines called ganglion cells, and they were not present in my colon. So they took out part of my colon at that point until they found where these ganglion cells are, and thought that that would fix what was going on. Unfortunately, that didn't fix it, and I ended up having multiple surgeries within the first 4 years of my life. They took out all of my colon and 17% of my small bowel. At first, I was misdiagnosed with Hirschsprung's disease, which mimics the symptoms of pseudoobstruction very closely. At 5 years old, I went to the University of California in Los Angeles, and that's where they did the did more testing, including the duodenal manometry study, and found out that I did in fact have pseudoobstruction. I am currently TPN dependent, so that's total parental nutrition. So I get all of my nutrition through an IV. So I've been dealing with this for all of my life. And I'm sure, as Mary Angela said, the unpredictability of these diseases is something that we have to adjust to in as best of a way as we can. As far as traveling goes, I've figured out quite a few ways to travel, even though with these diseases and how unpredictable they can be, travel can become a little bit more difficult. One of my main rules is I will not make any reservations for traveling if they don't have either a cancellation, rescheduling, or an insurance policy on it. Just because you don't know with these diseases, if something happens and you end up in the hospital and have to cancel or reschedule your trip, I don't want to be put in a position where I have to then pay even more money or lose my money altogether if I have to make changes to those reservations. So that's my one rule, my main rule. One of the other things that I do when traveling is I always make sure that my immediate medications that I need, so any type of anti-nausea medication that I need or any pain medication that I take, I always make sure that they're in the correct bottles and on me. If something happens and, you know, I end up with those symptoms, I can take my medication, you know, at any point. The other thing that I always do is, if at all possible, I never make plans for that first day of being wherever I'm traveling to, because of how travel can affect our bodies. I never want to make plans for that first day just in case those symptoms become exacerbated by travel and I'm unable to do anything that day. It is difficult to travel with these diseases, in the fact that you want to accomplish or do all these things, but your body is what dictates that. And sometimes you can't do all those things. Traveling with someone who understands that is very important. I'm lucky in the fact that my travel partner is okay with going out and doing things by himself. If I felt like he would be stuck in the hotel with me if I'm sick, I would feel really bad about that, and that would affect your traveling in general and as a whole. Those are just some of the things that I found have helped with traveling and, you know, the unpredictability of it all. And I was going to say something about what Mary Angela had talked about right before I came on the call, which was the unpredictability of medication and how it works. I, too, have had several issues where medications will work one day and then the next it won't, as well as the way that our bodies tend to digest things. I know for me, my body decides that it will absorb whatever it wants to whenever it wants to, or not absorb what it wants to whenever it wants to. So a lot of times when I'm taking oral medications, it seriously is a toss of the dice on whether or not I'm going to absorb those medications to even work. So I've found one trick that helps with that is if I can, for my medications, I will get liquid medications whenever possible because those tend to absorb easier, and also or any medications that I can do that are the quick absorb medications or one of the – I can't remember the actual what it is actually called, but the acronym is ODT, but it's a dissolvable medication that I take so that it, again, can hopefully be a little bit more easily absorbed. There's also some medications that will dissolve in your mouth and will actually go into your bloodstream through your gums. Sometimes, though, if you can get a medication like that, that might also help in that way, just because of the fact that the absorption is so unpredictable that you go and, you know, you're having a symptom and you have a medication that could possibly help with those symptoms, but you want to try to do whatever you can to make sure that you can actually absorb those.
Excellent suggestions. One other thing that I want to just bring up before we invite some people, callers, to make their comments or questions, and that is, in fact, I just got up a phone call this morning with a patient. So what I'm going to say is so common. The patient goes for a test. It's a digestive motility test. Some patients have already had a diagnosis, but they're going again to get either another opinion or to get some sort of a status on the progression of their disease. They go, and the test result comes back negative. And then they go take that test again, and now it comes out positive. And it is so, so frustrating to patients when they go, but I have this diagnosis, I still have the symptoms, and yet the test is coming out negative. And my answer to that is sometimes when you're taking these tests, your gut may not be in that exacerbated mode enough for them to, with the tests that are available now, where it's going to really depict the actual result of what is going on with you physically. So in summary, what I say is, do not doubt yourself. If you are experiencing symptoms, and especially if you already have a diagnosis and then suddenly the symptoms have gotten worse, or you're in that reprise mode and it's just your symptoms aren't as apparent, don't get discouraged and don't lose faith in yourself, because you know your body better than anyone else. So it's important that you stay convicted to your diagnosis and the test, and trusting that your doctor believes you. Let's see if anybody on this in the program who is called in, does anybody have any comment or question?
Mary Angela, this is Anam.
Hello, Anam.
Hi, and I'm calling to say I really enjoy the show, number one. Number two, as far as traveling goes, I don't travel anymore because of the motility as well as all of my other symptoms, arthritis and bathroom issues, and this morning, the unpredictable nature of the bowels are 1 minute I'm fine, the next minute I gotta, you know, rush to the bathroom and I have no feeling down there. And as far as that happened to me with the test one time, I knew I had gastroparesis and we went for a gastric emptying study and the test came back negative. Well, then later they did the SIDS marker study test. For those of you that don't know what it is, you swallow a capsule and it comes back. You take a capsule and then they see where it went. Well, when they did the SIDS marker study, it showed that stuff took 2 weeks to go through, even though the gastric emptying study said everything was fine. This was several years ago. And Mary Angela, thank you for hosting this today.
Oh, it is my privilege, and thank you for tolerating all the little technical glitches as I relearn this whole panel, because we had these programs years ago, and then we decided to start them again. But, of course, with everything else, the system that we use changed their whole platform. So there's a learning curve, but we'll get it all perfected, I am sure.
We'll manage. And speaking of events, I have a very important event coming up October 20th, and I was deciding I'm not going to eat. It's the 40th anniversary of the Bell Awards, hard to believe, but I'm not going to eat. I'm going to take the food home, because if I get sick, what do I do? Throw up in front of 500 people, you know, and the year I won, I was fine, but with this, I don't eat. I just sip some water and just enjoy the show. And so it's very challenging. Do any of you with the paresis, I know a lot with me, I have trouble sleeping because of it. Do you have trouble, Mary Angela? Do you have trouble, Brittany, sleeping? I find that sleeping is so difficult because, you know, I'll have an enema and then and not be able to sleep. Do you have trouble sleeping?
Good question. Thank you for your comments and questions. So with sleeping, the answer to that is a resounding yes. It's not only with gastroparesis, but it's with a lot of other digestive motility disorders. What I say is I don't sleep, I nap. And I could be, my eyes would close and I could be in a slumber for 5 minutes and then I wake up. And I do not get a good night's sleep. I don't remember what it's like. Part of that is because... part of it is because the symptoms are so acute. Part of it is I can't regulate my body temperature, so I have autonomic things going on as well. And some of it is the pain, the nausea, the vomiting. There are so many factors that there are a lot pending on the symptoms. But even when I had some other secondary medical problem, it still did not... even a cold does not make me sleep any more than this. Even with pills, it doesn't help me to sleep. Brittany, how about you?
Yeah, I too have issues sleeping. More so, as time goes on, I used to be okay sleeping, but actually I would say that it's gotten really a lot worse in the last couple of years. But I've found now that I do more nap than sleep. Once I'm asleep, I'm okay for a little while, but if I get up to use the washroom or wake up for any reason, I won't go back to sleep for a long time. So I do end up reading quite a bit.
That's what I do, and my phone, because to be honest with you, the last time I had a good night's sleep really was 2001 before I got the illness. Once I became sick in 2002, sleeping went down the drain.
Which really amazes me, because what I see in many patients is with what little sleep we get, our bodies are almost used to functioning on this low energy, low sleep, that it's amazing how much we can function. And part of that is sheer willpower. And what I say, just powering through your illness. I have found in my own personal case that my days are certainly much shorter than they used to be, mm-hmm. as far as the productivity. And I refuse to nap during the day. I'm such an uncooperative patient. I just refuse, because I only have so many hours and so much energy to try to get things done. But once that abbreviated day, I can see that energy waning to the point where now I'm becoming a little bit more dysfunctional. That's it. I get up to call it a day. So let's see. Does anybody else want to? Oh, go ahead, Brittany.
No, I was just going to say I'm a little bit more cooperative than you are, Mary Angela. At some point, my body will just say, I do need to catch up on sleep, and I will spend pretty much a whole day sleeping, or at least multiple napping. But I'll say that only happens once every couple of weeks now. But otherwise, I'm running on little sleep as well. I am a little bit less active than I was, but I'm still awake a lot more than I used to be.
Yeah. The nights can be very long, very long.
Yeah.
But, you know, the day to me is very short because of my time where I can truly function at a logical and comprehensive way. Anybody else want to jump into the conversation? No. Okay. So what I wanted to discuss a little more is having that courage to venture out of your house, because the symptoms are so unpredictable. You just never know. And there have been many times when I have ventured out and the symptoms have become full-blown. I have never vomited in front of everybody. However, there have been times when I left discreetly and vomited. Of course, when I vomit, the whole world hears it. But it happens.
Yeah.
I'm not a quiet vomiter. And then the other thing
neither.
Is, the whole world is just the way I do things. Everything is loud with me. And then the other thing is that I've had the esophageal spasms, and then my voice will continue to go. So I totally lose my voice. And even doing this program today, yesterday my voice was disappearing, and I didn't even know if I would have a voice today. So it's by the grace of God that I'm able to speak. But after this program ends, I may not be able to because of spasms. So it does take a lot of risk, and there have been times when the symptoms come, but I have become very good in public places like a store, a supermarket, where I will just kind of hide the symptoms as well as I can until I can get into the car and then just be, which sometimes I've left my cart in the middle of the store and had to leave because I had to go in the car and lie down. So these are definite concerns with patients. And then I remind myself, well, if it happens in public, what's the worst thing? You're going to have people that will help you. And oh, well, you know. You can't control every aspect. Brittany, have you had things like that happen to you where you're outside of your home and then these things happen? And then how do you mentally cope?
Oh, yes, definitely. I used to actually joke that I am the master of vomiting because I've actually gained the ability to do it quite discreetly. And one trip in particular, I was in the car and all of a sudden I was going to vomit, and it was going to happen. I couldn't stop it. And somehow I turned around and put my like head through or into like the back seat, and there was a big, like one of those like giant to-go cups from, I don't know whether it was a fast food or something like that, that happened to be empty. And somehow I ended up vomiting in that cup while we were driving. Well, I wasn't driving, but I was the passenger, and made it into that cup. So I somehow, yeah, I will say that I am the master when it comes to that. I also used to joke that there isn't a tree in the Disney World area that I haven't vomited on. But
nice to know, Brittany. Thank you for that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's been quite a few years, so you guys are all safe now. But I've learned ways to at least try to keep it a little bit more discreet if I feel like I need to. The other thing for me was, vomiting in a public bathroom isn't the most pleasant of things. So definitely trying to, figure out a way to do it without kneeling down on the floor, things like that. The other way of coping I've found is just to, as I've gotten older, I've kind of more accepted it and just said this is what has to happen, and sorry. That's the most you can do, is just apologize if you're doing something that needs apologizing for. But otherwise, the people that, I surround myself with, as far as people that I go outside with and things like that, are people who support me and will do whatever they need to do to, help me with that situation, whether it be getting me back to the car or finding me a place to sit down or finding me a bathroom, whatever it ends up being. Those are the people that I usually, those are the people that I go out with. So if I'm out of the house, I'm usually, 90% of the time I'm with someone. And if I am, it's somebody that cares about me that will help me in whatever way that they can.
Brittany, out of everything you said, I'm just really impressed that when you vomited in that cup, that the vomit fit into that cup and didn't overflow.
Yeah.
I don't know how big the cup is.
Like I said, it was a big cup.
I think another thing that so many people are struggling with is you make plans. So you have friends or family who invite you to an event, whether it's just going to a store, seeing a movie, whatever it may be. And you say, okay. And then minutes before, you say, oops, sorry, I can't go. And not only do a lot of friends and family members get impatient, because if it's a continuing thing, then they don't understand, and they're going to stop perhaps inviting you to different things. And the other thing too is that if you say yes and then you say no, it can precipitate guilt on your part. And I know with my family, I have the most wonderful family. And when my nieces got married, they actually had their wedding early, not because they wanted to, but because they were so mindful of my inability to be out late in the afternoon and evening that they literally made their special day in their lives early so that I could attend. And that meant so much to me. I know it meant so much to them, that because they really wanted me there. But, and I'm a cheap date because it doesn't cost anything for me to attend functions because I don't eat. But at the same time, it meant so much to me that they were willing to accommodate me in a way that no matter what, their husbands, their now husbands, and themselves, and the entire family wanted to include me in such a special way. So that really meant a lot to me. Brittany, I don't know if you've had any experience with that, and then we're going to open it up to even more callers. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've had some experience with this. I found when I was growing up with this illness, especially in high school, I had a harder time with making plans and having to cancel them because friends weren't as accepting of that. And there was a point where I was having to either cancel or change plans quite a bit. I was having a, you know, more difficult time. And I ended up losing a friend over it because they thought that I would just kept blowing them off. And even though I explained the situation and they knew that I was sick, they felt like I was just not putting up my part of the friendship like they were. So they stopped inviting me and eventually stopped, you know, wanting to be around me at all.
Brittany, may I make a comment?
Yeah.
This is an omen. A friend of mine recently broke up with me, known for years, because, well, you're not the same as you once were, and you can't go out or you can't do different things, and
yeah.
So we broke up, and she's like, I don't want to deal, I don't want to have anything to do with you, and it's sad, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. It is sad, and it's difficult, and you have to eventually get to that point where you realize that, you know, maybe that friendship isn't what you thought it was, and you need to move on. I will say that since being with my significant other, his family has actually been the ones to accommodate for me. They will, for holidays, they will make sure it's early enough in the day so that I can feel as good as I, you know, do. You know, it, for me, like Mary Angela, the earlier it is, the better it is for us. So they will make the plans earlier, and they will make sure that they even go as far as if we're just having dinner at their house and they're having, say, you know, steak on the grill, and they know that I can't eat that, they will make sure that there is something there that I can eat. Same thing for drinks and everything else. They're super accommodating, and I'm very, very grateful for them for that. But it is difficult more with, you know, certain friends and growing up with, you know, being social and in school, those kind of friends, you know, a lot of times that's the most difficult part. When you get older and people do become more mature and realize that there's more important things than you just can't, you know, changing plans or canceling plans, it becomes easier. But I know for me and for a lot of people in those high school years and the college years and the, you know, early 20 years, those are very difficult for you when you have to keep changing and making other arrangements or canceling plans. That's the most difficult time, I believe. It happens when you get older too, but I feel like in those early years, because you do have a bigger social circle, generally speaking, that's when it seems like it comes up more often.
And it's amazing how many things circle around food. All social functions mm-hmm. are food. And although I've never had friends leave me with that, certainly, and people have been very accommodating, even for family and friends who are accommodating to me, there are times when what I say is I pick my battles and I take risks. And even mm-hmm. though I go to an event, and especially during the holidays, my family has all of the traditional holidays and they're big events with our family, it takes all the courage and stamina to power through everything and be there, because I so want to. It's so disappointing when you have to miss things, which I have. But I know that I'm going to pay a price for that, maybe for a day, 2 days, and probably a week. It's going to take me that long to try to get back on my feet. But to me, it's worth it because I really don't want to miss. I don't want to see my whole life pass by and not be engaged or involved with the people that I care about. So I know that's happened to other people, whether it's going to a concert and all this. When you want to do something, you just say, okay, symptoms, it's between you and me, and today it's my day, and then I'll visit you people later, even though I'm going to be in pain. Anybody else want to join in? Or have a comment or question? Or talk about their experience? We have such a, and we have quite a few people, but they're all very quiet, except, but that's okay.
I was just going to say one other thing, echoing what you just said, Mary Angela, about taking those calculated risks, talking back about the travel. I have actually a trip coming up next month. I will be, speaking of Disney, I'll be back in Disney. Watch out, people. I will be back in Disney. But I know that time there is going to take a lot out of me. I've made some arrangements as far as trying to make it as easy on myself as possible. I do, when I'm traveling, nine times out of ten am riding around in a wheelchair because I will get too exhausted otherwise. Riding in a wheelchair makes it so that I can be out for a little bit longer and enjoy my trip. But I know that I will be paying for it when I get home, but that's something that I'm willing to do. I want that experience. I want to have fun. I want to live my life. And for me, Disney holds a very dear place in my heart since I was sent down to Disney when I was 5 years old with Make-A-Wish. So that has always held a very important place in my heart, and I get to actually go down there with my significant other for the first time. So this is something that I'm looking forward to, but I'm also nervous about, and know that when I get home, I'm not making any plans to leave my house for at least a week, because it will probably take me at least that long to recover. But it's, again, what Mary Angela said, you have to take those calculated risks sometimes, and you have to, and just how she said, you know, it takes courage to take those calculated risks and to do things that you know are going to, that you know are most likely going to make you pay in one way or another. I think it's also just as brave to have to change plans and or cancel plans and or say, I can't do something. I think it takes just as much courage to say no to something as to say yes and know that you're going to pay, because of the fact that you're being proactive about your own health and you're taking your own health as first priority, which with our motility issues is really important. We have to be selfish in some ways and put our health first before other issues, because otherwise we aren't going to be able to do anything the next day or, you know, live a life that we want to live.
I agree. Like with this 40th anniversary of the Bell, I will go. I will just sip some water. A lot of people sit at my table. Aren't you hungry? And I just say, no, I'm not hungry. Taking the food home, and I'm not, because I choose to enjoy the show, because they have the former winners stand up and be recognized, and I don't want to vomit. So I just go and enjoy the show and take the food home and eat later, and I know if I eat the steak or whatever and I have to go in the bathroom, I just go in the bathroom and vomit and still volunteer. And even when I, to tell you how much I love volunteering, when I was in the hospital the day after my hernia surgery, I went for all of you, by the way, I still made my calls. I was still sick in the hospital with hernia surgery, about to die, and I called my clients. Hi, this is Alan with Telecare. You doing okay? Yeah, I'm in the hospital, but I'm checking on you. And I want you to know I saved my volunteer company $5,693, and I was number one for Telecare, even with the challenges. So I still try to manage, even though I feel yucky. But I love you, Mary Angela, and you make me smile.
Oh, my gosh. You're so kind, Nina. But I have to say,
you make
too,
me smile.
you're very, very kind. But I have to say, too, and Brittany, what you were saying about taking care of yourself and being selfish, for some people like myself, which I always say, do as I say, don't do as I do, I am not the poster child of the right way to do a lot of the things that I do for the over 38 years or whatever it is that I've been going through this. But in my mind, sometimes I say, you know what? You can do this. And we're going to just get through this. And it's like a little mind game, even though you know in your heart that you really can't. So saying no to events does not come naturally. I'm even willing to sacrifice my health sometimes just so that I can participate and be with my loved ones or do whatever I need to do. But you shouldn't do that. As Brittany said, there are times when you really need to assess your health. And I shouldn't say that I should not give the impression that I just say yes all the time. My family knows better too. Not to, they'll ask, but they understand. They certainly don't expect me to go to any programs late in the afternoon or evening. So I have really a great world and support system. And my husband, who is on the shyer side, certainly appreciates that he doesn't have to go to these functions alone or have to go late at night, because he'd rather be with me. And of course there's that worry factor too. He doesn't like to go out because he's always worried about me if he has to go alone. So but taking care of your health and being mindful, and also keeping that thought in mind that you're going to go, but there is an extremely strong possibility that you may pay a price for it. And that price may not happen that next day. All of a sudden, a few days later, you may be going, what the heck is wrong with me? And it could be that. And that can be compounded, too, if you're also juggling other diseases along with it. Because I know some people who have motility disorders have secondary causes. So all these things to keep in mind. It isn't easy, but it certainly is worthwhile, the effort. And also, it's doable. It's just really, I think once you come to the point, at least this is what's happened in my life, and I see that it's happened in others, once you come to that point of acceptance that this is what you have, you're not giving acquisition and saying, well, this is the way life is going to be for me, and I'm not going to get any help, and I'm just going to have to live like this with a poor quality of life. It isn't that at all. It's more just saying that you are going to be able to deal with it and learn how to do it in the right way. And that's so important. It really is. Brittany, are you still there? Uh-oh. Okay, hold on. Brittany, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry. I am fooling with the controls. because I could hear somebody washing their dishes in the background. Okay, so we're getting some reverb here. So mute me, Brittany, I'm going to keep you on, and I'm going to mute some other people.
Yeah, okay. I wonder if it's been...
There we go.
A call just got dropped. The person went to talk, and we just got dropped. And that was the person who we were getting feedback from. Hopefully, they'll call again. So, yeah, Brittany, did you want to say something?
Yes. I just, echoing what you said about, you know, acceptance and stuff, and we talk about that a lot. But acceptance doesn't mean, and a lot of people get confused because they think that acceptance means just giving in and giving up. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about understanding that your life has changed and some things need to be reevaluated, and you need to, you know, make accommodations for this new life. That doesn't mean that we're saying, you know, to give up life itself. We're just saying make those accommodations that need to be done, and put your health as a priority so that you can have those fun experiences and live a great life. Just because you have these motility issues, it's a great life to live. It also helps, I think, have these kind of programs and the other kind of programs that ADMD offers to talk to other people that have motility issues, or if you don't, or if you have, you know, a church group or social circle to talk about, you know, what you're feeling and the frustrations that you may have about these issues that come up regarding your motility issues. And that helps, I think, talking to other people with it and talking to friends, close friends, therapists, doctors, you know, like I said, people in a church or whatever, religious circle. All of these things help to help you to live the best life you can with how unpredictable everything is. I don't know if, Mary Angela, you talked about it before, but also journaling helps a lot too, not only for release of emotions and thoughts and feelings, but also you can look back at that journal and actually use it as a tool to help doctors to help you, because you can go back and look at it and say, oh, okay, this day and this day I was in pain, this day and this day I was experiencing, you know, this symptom, and then that could actually help you talk to your doctor to find maybe a different course of treatment that would help you, so that maybe you don't experience those symptoms all the time, or maybe doing that can also help you to nail down something that you do that may trigger a symptom that you don't realize until you look back and go, oh, every time I was nauseous, I did X, and that might help too.
Yeah,
those
Brittany,
are my two cents for today.
Brittany, I think that caller is back, so let me see if we can get that caller back. Hi.
Hello.
There he is.
Hello. Oh, my goodness. I'm Dr. John Lieberman. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm listening to the show here. Very interesting. I'm 66 years old, so I've been in a general surgeon for some time, and I have dealt a great deal with digestive motility disorders, and my approach is somewhat non-traditional in that I am a surgeon, but I have found that multiple modalities of treatment, including chiropractic care, naturopathic care, osteopathic care, any type of care that helps bring relief to the individual, and it's a very frustrating situation, and my heart goes out to all the individuals that have this, and I believe that it's as complicated as migraine headaches or fibromyalgia. It's tied into sleep disorders. It's tied into everything, and I don't believe that there's a single answer to this, and I believe that it's like many areas in medicine, we don't have the answers. And I believe that in medicine, especially in surgery, we sometimes, the easiest thing to do is to go ahead and get out the knife. But that's the last thing that I think I should do. And I'm touched by everyone's comments. And I also want to say to Brittany, ODT stands for under the tongue. And I just, it for whatever reason, I don't know what the O stands for, but DT is, I just call it the tongue. And that's how I always remember that. I write for Zofran, ODT. And it's a great medication. And I'm hoping that in the future there will be accommodations for travel. I believe that it's all part of the American Disabilities Act, that there ought to be ways that the airlines should accommodate every individual in their travel needs. But I don't know quite how to do that. It's a political issue. So anyway, I'm listening, and I just wanted to jump in. I'm probably the only surgeon who's listening. If there are others, please chime in. But interesting program.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on and for your input. And one of the points you did bring up is the alternative type of care. And I know that some patients use acupuncture, acupressure, massage. And I know for myself, for the nausea, not only am I taking that Zofran, that medication, but I also have what's called a relief band, and it's a device that looks like a regular watch. It's years ago, Dr. Richard McCallum from the University of Texas, Texas Tech, who was originally in the University of Kansas Medical, and he was the one who brought that to my attention. And what it does is, It's people use it for motion sickness, and they also use it for chemotherapy as well as pregnancy, the effects of the nausea and vomiting. And I know in the stores you can always see those little C bands, and they're like a terry cloth thing, and then they have this little white dot, and you're supposed to put it on a point with it on your wrist that relate to acupuncture. Those are just pretty to wear, but for me, they were never, I didn't see any change. But with this relief band in conjunction to that medication, it sometimes, not always, but can sometimes take that edge off. And so there are five settings on it, and it has to be placed in a certain way on that wrist, and it's on the underside of your wrist. You put a little bit of gel, conductive gel, and then you put this band on, and then you can put it onto the settings that you have, that you want, and those do work on that acupuncture point within the wrist that can help to at least take off a little bit of that edge. Another device that people use for abdominal pain is that TENS unit, and they put these little leads onto their belly. Some even put it onto their back because there is that relationship. And some people, I didn't find that effective, but some people do find that effective. And with that massage, yeah, oh no, go ahead, Nina.
With the TENS unit, I found that effective for my arm because I had an injury, and that was helpful. And but I never looked into getting a TENS unit, but I found it helpful at one point. And
yeah, see, there are many options out. The only thing that I say is be sure that you consult with your physician, or when they're saying what other treatments are you taking, be sure to put that on so that they know what's going on. Because if you're taking a medication and then you're trying alternative medicines, then we don't know if it's a medication or the alternative medicine that is having an impact, if it is. So just little tips. But sometimes if I'm in an acute state and I'm getting that abdominal pain and distension that's way off the charts, and my husband will massage my back, which can sometimes take that that little spasm of motility, relieve it to a certain degree. Not always, but again, sometimes. And if you can use these different techniques and devices when you have to go someplace, they can be really beneficial. So a little food for thought. Yes, go ahead.
May I make a comment and ask a question?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. The comment is, I believe that spirituality, and I first of all, I'm not a religious person, but I believe as a surgeon, spirituality is an important part of any healing process, whether you're Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu. I don't think it matters. I believe that looking to one's own spiritual strength is very much a part of the whole process. It's as important as the medical or the psychological. I believe that it's all interwoven. Now, my mm-hmm. question is, what about parents? How do everybody here, it seems like most of the listeners are individuals that have motility problems. What can parents do to help in this situation? And also, what are some insights that you can give parents in terms of how they might better be part of a support network or part of the team that is helping with the healing process?
So thank you for your comments and thank you for your questions. So Brittany, before I pass it to you, I just want to say that in my own personal life, and I absolutely agree with you, my faith is truly what has kept me alive, because with the way my health has deteriorated, there is no medically explainable reason as to why I'm still here. So I just feel blessed every day, and it certainly changes your perspective. And trying to maintain that positive attitude is so important as well, because if you live in the bowels of depression and negativity all the time, it can get to you so much that you no longer function. And we all have too much fighting in us. As far as parents are concerned, I think that parents, our organization actually offers a telephone internet program specifically for parents. And it's such a great program because parents can interact, they can share their emotions, they can share their tips, and they can share their questions. What I say to parents, and I remember this even with my own parents, that constant worry in their eyes, that some parents feel that they feel helpless because they can't take that pain away from their child, no matter what age the child is, and they don't know what else to do. And what I always say to parents is, if you care and you love them and you're there to support them and listen, you are doing more than you can possibly realize, because these diseases can be so isolating. And the fact that that child has some place to go to where they feel comfortable enough to share their inner feelings and their symptoms to somebody who loves them and will not judge them, that's huge. That's absolutely huge. So there are resources through AGMD. There are also, and we have in-person support groups in Massachusetts as well. And then we have that telephone internet program that certainly can help. And then we have some literature that can help. Brittany, do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. As far as parents go, no, I'm not a parent. But growing up with this disease, so I've been through the whole thing. I know for me, for my own situation, my parents were completely instrumental in, well, A, me being here in the first place, and I don't just mean because they're my parents, but they advocated for me, and they were the ones fighting for me. To get the care that I needed, to get the accommodations that I needed for school. And a lot of this stuff was back, was, you know, 30 years ago when it wasn't as widely known about the different accommodations that you can have for your child. Now it's more, people are more aware of it, and 9 times out of 10, schools will be the ones that initiate those things, but my parents were the ones spearheading all of that. So
parents
advocating for your child.
Hold on, Brittany. Waiting for a minute. We're getting some interference. And it's gone. Okay.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's why I stopped talking. For parents to educate themselves about the disease or diseases, not only educate in the sense of, learning about the signs, symptoms, treatments, things like that, but also educating themselves about what is happening to their child and what their child is feeling, and letting their child be honest about how much pain they're in or what their symptoms are, and if they're too young to vocalize it, try to figure out a different way for their child to explain it. So I know my parents used a baby doll a lot of the time, and I would point on the baby doll where it hurt on me, and figuring things out like that. And above all, just being that support for your child and not judging them if they, can't go to school or, a test or something like that. Just being there, being that support. And, of course, I'm a big proponent of, using the resources that are out there. So things like therapy and, going to a psychologist and having your child have someone that is safe to talk to. Because as much as my parents were there and didn't judge me and understood everything that was going on with me, I also wanted to shield my parents from a lot of things. So sometimes I didn't tell them quite as much pain as I was in. So if I was experiencing a day that was, a 6 or a 7, I would say, oh, it's only a 4. Because as I got older, I didn't want my parents to worry. So having somewhere that I could be really honest and not have any feel any judgment or repercussions from that, so going to somebody like a therapist would really help kids as well as parents. And then as I've gotten older, the other thing that I found is really important for parents is to take care of themselves, because a lot of their energy is being expended into taking care of their child, which is understandable. But if you're not taking care of yourself, you're not going to be there to take care of your child. And a lot of times in couples who have chronically ill children, the divorce rate is really high. And I think that it's important to talk about that and to have parents, realize that they do have to, continue to work with their partner. And if that involves, again, therapy or counseling or whatever else, then they need to do that and they need to take care of themselves, because if they're not taking care of themselves, they will not be here to take care of their children in the future. And I think
Brittany,
all of those are just extremely important.
Brittany, may I make a comment?
Mm-hmm.
When you mentioned about the divorce rate, I want to tell you, it was just the opposite with my family. Because of all my challenges being a preemie, it brought mom and dad closer 100 times more. And mom has always been very supportive, and dad has too, with the getting the right medical care, getting the right help. When I was sick, dad encouraged mom, find out why she's not going to the bathroom, do all the things, and they've always been, real supportive as far as that goes, and mom is here always things, and so, sometimes dad didn't understand it always, but he just was supportive in that way, always letting me get the right medical care. and
see, that's so important. Yeah,
I
just want to say that, and I know we're getting off track a little bit, but relationships either strengthen or crumble when it comes to these disorders. And the last thing that I want to say on that particular point is that one of the difficulties that they also face is, especially with an older child, the decision. It's so easy to want to say, well, you should be doing this, or you should be doing that, or why don't you take that test, or why don't you try this food? And it's because they so want to get you better, and they so want to help.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes it can really affect that patient, that child, because they're living it, and though they want that support and love, they may not necessarily want other people making the decision for them. So just a little note to keep in mind. I'm hearing an echo, Brittany. Are you hearing the echo?
Yeah.
Okay,
yes,
so then it's got to be coming from somebody else's set. So I'm going to have you talk for a little bit so I can figure out why I'm echoing now.
Okay. I hope you guys can't hear echoing when I'm talking. But going back to the unpredictable nature of these diseases, I think the other issue, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating what Mary Angela said in the beginning because I wasn't able to get on, but I found the other thing that was hard to deal with the unpredictable nature of these diseases is figuring out if you can work or not. I know for myself, it was very difficult for me to come to the realization that I wouldn't be able to work anymore. But I found that with this unpredictability of my symptoms, I could work at one point, but I never knew from day to day or from hour to hour a lot of times whether or not I would be okay enough to work. And I actually did myself a disservice because I kept working, even though I probably should have stopped a long time before that. But I kept working because I have this, you know, work ethic that's been ingrained into me that you go to work when you're scheduled to work. And unless you're in the hospital, you still go to work. And I did that, and I ended up getting really sick because I kept pushing through that. And I would be going to work, but, you know, going in the bathroom and getting sick multiple times. And I would actually be harder on myself because I'm thinking in my own head that I'm at work, yeah, but I'm not doing work. And that was a real big problem for me. So figuring out if you can continue to work with these conditions is a tough one, and it takes, you know, it takes a lot of soul searching to figure that out on whether or not you can or can't, or maybe changing a career, or if you can do things like telecommute, or, you know, cutting down hours, things like that also can help. For me, I had to come to the realization that I would not be able to hold a job. I got too sick. I got to the point where I was spending more time in bed than out, and I had to come to that conclusion that I couldn't work. And I know that that is something that a lot of people struggle with, including myself. And also, if anybody is, you know, younger listening to this too, the same thing goes for school. Some people, when they're, you know, younger and experiencing these issues, miss a lot of school and have to figure out what to do as far as that goes, whether or not to continue to go to school or if, and it's a great thing that we, you know, live in 2017 because a lot of things can be done remotely. So there is more availability to, you know, go to school online or, you know, have do school part-time, you know, actually going to the school only part-time. there's a lot of different accommodations that can be made that way, which I think is just amazing, so that people don't have to give up as much, and they can figure out different ways around their disease to make things a bit easier on themselves.
Yeah, excellent, excellent point, Brittany. And I know myself, and we've had so many programs on that employment part, and we will continue to have programs regarding the employment part. But I know there are other patients who, and I'm just giving this example, they work and they have diarrhea. And with diarrhea, it's really hard to even contain that, just like vomiting. You just can't control it. That's something that you really can't hide. And so strategically figuring out, okay, I have to go to work. Where's the bathroom? Should I go early before anybody comes, or they plug themselves up with Imodium so that they don't have to deal with the consequences of having to use the bathroom and then having to somebody use it right after them? So again, everything is a risk and everything is strategic. And even when I go someplace, even to our in-person support group meeting, I know exactly where that bathroom is, because in case I have to get up in an emergency, I can exit and I know where it is. And even in a hotel, wherever it may be, I know where all the exits are and I know where all the bathrooms are as soon as I walk in. It gives me a little bit more comfort. It is not going to affect the symptoms at all, but it gives you a little bit of reassurance that if it gets out of control, you have an exit or you know where to go. So it's like everything with these motility disorders, it's a balancing act. And even when I was teaching, when I was employed, and this was the beginning of my journey, totally by surprise, I would be fine. And as a teacher, like many other jobs, you need a lot of energy when you're dealing with children. And when you multiply not one child, but a whole classroom of children, you have to be animated, you have to be on point, and you don't want the children to know that you're not feeling good. So there were times when, again, it was by the grace of God that I made it through classes. And then there would be days that, you know, for that 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, it was good, and then suddenly I'd start to feel that same feeling of what's going on with my gut. I have a background also in theater, which has helped, because I have the capacity to be able to hide a lot of what's going on, and which we're going to be having a program on, and which we've had many times, is that you don't look ill. And so by putting a smile on my face and camouflaging how I feel in places where I cannot totally reveal the hands on my cards, that has been very, very helpful. Is it 100% guaranteed? Well, no, but it's 99%, unless somebody knows me really well, that I am just trying to get through this, knowing that I have to escape pretty quickly because I don't know how long I'm going to be able to endure putting on that face of I'm okay and I can still engage in talking and I don't have to just leave. Or I have the ability to excuse myself, run to the bathroom, vomit or do whatever, and then come back and still be able to function. My problem, too, is compounded because I have autonomic problems. So there are times when I feel like I'm just going to pass out. Again, it's by the grace of God. I haven't passed out in front of everybody, and I'm sure I will draw a lot of attention when I do, but oh well, you know. It's part of coping, and I've had a long time to deal with all of this. Mm-hmm. I certainly am not the same as I was at the beginning of the journey, where I was so self-conscious and still trying to put my brain around what was happening to my life and my husband's life and my family's life and trying to cope with all these symptoms. So It certainly has been an interesting journey. As I tell people, I wouldn't have been the first one to hold up my hand and go, yes, pick me. Yes, pick me. But seeing though I have been given this life, I have been so blessed in so many ways. Certainly not in losing my health. That has not been the journey that I was anticipating. However, I have learned that I am so capable of doing things that I never thought I would. I also have met such extraordinary people who I most likely never would have met as a result of not having the disease. And it has changed me. I think it's changed my perspective on life. It changes so many people's perspective because you value every breath that you that God has given you to breathe. So I've been dealing with this for so long that I can barely remember what life was like not having it, because I've learned to accept it and just adjust. And when I get a new disease or new symptoms, which is always happening to me, I roll my eyes and go, oh my God, no, what's next? But I just go with the waves, go with the flow of things, because I know a lot of things are out of my control. And believe me, those who know me know I'm a control person. So learning to let go and learning to just pretend that I can control some things. And if Melissa is on this call, I'm sure she can relate to this because she is the same way with me, like me. But I will control the way I put things in a cabinet. All the cup handles have to be a certain way, God forbid, if you don't put it a certain way. But it's just my way of saying, you know what, I can't control and I can't predict some things that are going to happen, but I can open that cabinet and be reassured that all these silly little things are in the right place. Just my little way of coping. Brittany, do you have any comment? We only have a couple minutes left.
Yeah, I agree with you. I like to control as much as I can. And I, too, because there's so much of this disease that you can't control, I tend to control everything else that I can control. And I also believe for myself, I accept a lot easier and cope a lot easier if I always have a backup plan or five, one of the two. That helps me too, because I always feel like, okay, well, if I have that backup plan, if it doesn't go this way, then I'm still okay. It'll, you know, if this happens. And I too, you know, I always say that I've been blessed in the fact that I was born with this disease. So I don't know what it is to be healthy. That doesn't mean that it isn't still difficult for me and I don't have, you know, times where it's harder than others, but I'm lucky because I don't know what it is to be perfectly healthy. I make light of things and I do use humor to cope with a lot of it, which is how it works for me. And some people are the same and some people are different, but you have to figure out what works best for you. And it's not going to be the same for every person. Just like we aren't all the same. Just like, you know, we all have different issues with motility. We all have different ways of coping, and you have to figure out what works best for you. And it's kind of like, you know, trying on clothes. You got to keep trying until you find that perfect fit. But once you do, it makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, great. And Brittany, we are coming down to the close of the program. I want to thank all of those who were able to listen in or talk. And also, Brittany, thank you for your assistance with while I'm trying to get all these technical things learned and mastered. But I think that the information in this program was so vital, and it's such an important topic that so many patients and their families struggle with. And you are all heroes. You are all the inspiration behind our organization and really behind programs like this. Please don't be strangers to the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders. God bless you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Precision medicine holds great promise for treating genetic diseases, such as certain types of cancers. To drive progress, Harvard Business School Executive Education has developed a new program, Accelerating Innovation in Precision Medicine, which brings together leaders from business, science, medicine, and technology to explore new models for advancing personalized medicine. The program takes place on the Boston campus in September. Learn more by clicking the banner or visiting hbs.me/precision. That's hbs.me/precision.